Hello and welcome to 42 Talks, the podcast that takes a deep dive into the legal world, guided by the experienced members of 42 BR Barristers. This is the first episode in our podcast series, Trust Issues, talking about the law and practice of trusts. And this first episode is about Tolata, the basics. My name is Iris Ferber, KC, and I am a barrister at 42BR, specialising in property law.
And I am Alex Bailey, and I am also a barrister at 42BR, specialising in property law. Iris, you've been a barrister a lot longer than I have, and I haven't done a lot of these cases yet, and so I thought I'd ask you some questions about the basics. One thing I do know is what Tolata is, and it's a very wordy act, which no one really likes to say, hence why we all say Tolata. But for our purposes, it stands for the Trusts of Land and Appointment of Trustees Act 1996. And so, what's it all about, Iris?
Good first question, Alex. It is a piece of law that is usually used as the process going through court to resolve disputes between couples who break up and are not married. So you use Tolata as the law that governs what to do with the house after a breakup when the law of divorce isn't available to sort that out. And that will include whether or not to sell the house, if the house is going to be sold, when, and how much to sell it for. But, Alex, although that's the typical sort of case that we see as barristers, it's actually significantly wider, Tolata, than just couples breaking up. And we're going to talk about that.
So thank you for that introduction. But to get us started, can I just ask firstly, what is a trust of land?
That's also a good question. And I think it's important to define our terms. So a trust of land is a trust of property that consists of or includes land. That's easy enough, isn't it? That's section 1.1 of Tolata. Of course, that isn't a good answer because all I've done there is turn the words of the question into the same words, but in an answer. That's not very useful. So although that's the definition in section 1 of Tolata, a trust of property that consists of or includes land, for the purposes of a real definition, what it actually is a situation where two or more people have an interest in the same piece of land, that whether that's a house or a flat or a piece of land without a house or a flat on it.
And so does that mean it only applies where my girlfriend and I are both named on the land register as the owners?
No, so an interest in land, so I said it was where two or more people have an interest in land. Interest in land does not just mean owning on the land registry. There are lots of other people, lots of other types of interests which are not on the land register. So that could be a situation where, for example, you buy the house in your name, so you are the only person on the register, but you've agreed with your girlfriend, say, and you've got a document to show it, that you actually both going to have an interest in that house or flat. Or you can have an alternative situation, which is what we tend to call an implied trust rather than an express trust, where, say, my husband and I live in a house. It's in my name on the land register, but actually my husband has done all kinds of things on the understanding that it's also his house. So he's put his money into it, he's done renovations, he's paid the mortgage, and that tends to create interests in land, even where he and I haven't necessarily agreed that we should have those interests. So interests are very, very broad. They are in express documents, and they can also be implied by conduct as well.
Just going back to basics, the words often used, trustees and beneficiaries. Can you just explain what those words mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is crucial to the law of trusts generally, and I'm sure that future podcasts will delve into these points in a lot more detail. But for the purposes of a Tolata claim, what you need to know about the difference between a trustee and a beneficiary is that conceptually, as lawyers, we split the ownership of a piece of land between the legal title, the piece of paper title, where you are the person on the land register who is named as the owner, and the beneficial ownership, which is who actually lives in, uses, and has rights in that house or that flat. So that's the conceptual difference. The, what we sometimes call the paper title owner, even though paper title is a kind of old-fashioned term, and the people who have an interest. The paper title owner is the trustee, and the people who have an interest in the land because they live there or they use it or they've spent money on it, they are the beneficiaries. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes sense. That comes back to what you said a little bit earlier, that if your husband, say, has spent some money on the property, he might have a beneficial interest, but he might not be the trustee of the property.
Absolutely.
That's right.
And he might not even realize at the time that that's creating a beneficial interest for him, because that's a technical term that only a lawyer would necessarily understand. But that doesn't matter. If somebody puts money in and has an expectation that they're going to have some rights as a result, even if they don't quite understand what that means or how to describe it, there's potentially a beneficial interest there.
This is a question also that comes up all the time. When people are buying houses and they see the transfer deeds, they see that they are either joint tenants or tenants in common. And people are often a little bit confused, as they aren't tenants, as they actually own the house. Could you explain what those terms actually mean in practice?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a good question in this podcast, because the terms joint tenants, tenants in common, also come up in Tolata. They are some of the defined terms in the Act, and they come up in the sections that are important in Tolata cases. The best way to think about it, and without giving you a history lesson on the law of property in England, the best way to think about the phrases joint tenant and tenant in common is that it is a different use of the word tenant. Do not think of the word tenant in those phrases as having the usual meaning that you would think of as tenant. All a joint tenancy or a tenancy in common means, in the context of ownership rather than landlord and tenant, is that it is two different ways of jointly owning a house. If you and I buy a house together, we can choose to either own it as joint tenants, legal joint tenants, or legal tenants in common. And by legal, I mean legal owners rather than beneficial owners. So as trustees, it's another way of putting it, we can either be tenants in common or joint tenants. And this is historic terminology. Trying to explain why we use these words is probably more, as I say, a history lesson than a useful explanation. But basically, a joint tenancy, so if you and I are joint tenants owning a house, we both own the whole house. It's not split up between us in any way, as a matter of law. Obviously, in the real world, it's not split up either way. But as a matter of law, there's no distinction. I own all of it. You own all of it. That's a joint tenancy situation. Whereas a tenants in common situation is where we both own the house, but we have agreed that I own 50%, or I own 40%, or I own 43.75%, any percentage you like, and you own the other 50% or 60% or whatever the other half of that weird percentage that I gave you was. So the difference is, tenancy in common is a specific split of percentages between the two legal owners, and a joint tenancy is we both own it all together.
Thank you. That's a very helpful summary. Just also going back to something you said earlier, you said Tolata is wider than only couples breaking up. So who else does it apply to if it's not just to couples?
Okay, well, that's defined in Tolata. So the Act says that the people who can make applications about what to do with land where there's more than one beneficiary and there's no agreement about what to do with that piece of land, the people who can make such an application are, number one, a trustee. So in our scenario where you and I have bought a house together, that's each of us. We are each a legal owner, so we are each a trustee, and each of us has their own right to make an application to court under Tolata to decide what to do with the house if we can't agree about it. So that's the first type. The second type of person is a person with an interest in property subject to a trust of land. So to bring that into the real world, that's where you and I both decide to go and live in a house together, but you buy it in your name only, but I have some kind of interest in it, either because we've agreed expressly to enter into a declaration of trust where I get 50% and you get 50%, but only you have gone on the land register, or we don't agree anything about that, but the way we behave means that there's an implied interest. Either way, I have an interest in that house, even though I'm not on the land register. You are on the land register, so you've got your right to go to court under Tolata as an owner, as a trustee. But I, as a person with an interest in that house, also have a right to go to court purely because I have an interest in that house. I don't have to be a person who is named on the land register in order to make a Tolata application. So it's that second category that is by far the largest proportion of people who bring Tolata claims. It's people who are not on the register but have an interest in a house and want the court to make a decision about what to do about it. There's another couple of criteria which are less common, but I'll mention them. There's a trustee in bankruptcy of a beneficiary. So if, again, in our scenario, we buy a house, it goes into your name, but I have an interest in it, and then I am declared bankrupt, then my trustee in bankruptcy has the right to make an application under Tolata. And actually, there are special rules about trustees and what rights they have in a Tolata application, which we are not going to talk about in this very short and basics level podcast. But worth knowing, trustee and bankruptcy claims are a bit different. And then finally, people who are owed money also can go to the court under Tolata. So that would be a mortgage company or any other secured creditor that has a security over the house. They can also make an application under Tolata. Generally speaking, they will want the house sold. That comes under Tolata.
So now we know who can apply. What powers does the court have and how will it exercise those powers? That's two different questions, though. So if it's all right with you, Iris, can we possibly start with what powers does the court have?
Well, Alex, to answer that, let me take a step back for a moment. The court is going to receive an application from a beneficiary or a one of two trustees or a creditor. Generally speaking, where there's a dispute about whether or not to sell the house. That's 99% of the time, that's what the applications are about. But it is worth also saying that the court also has the power to decide what the shares should be between beneficiaries, as well as making a decision about whether to sell the house or not. So there could be a number of different issues the court deals with before we get onto what the powers are. The court could be being asked, what are our shares in the house? Because we've never written anything down and we don't know. We want the court to decide what the shares are. Or I think my share is 50%, but you're saying that actually my share is 20% because I've put in a lot less money than I say I've put in to the house. So there's that dispute potentially about what the shares actually are that we're entitled to in terms of beneficial interest in the house. Court can decide that. Then follows on from that, okay, bearing in mind the proportion of the house that I own, should the house be sold in order for me to get my share out or not? And I suppose the other part, before we get onto powers, is do I have any interest at all? So before we get onto what my interest is, you might be saying, Iris doesn't have any interest in this house. This is all entirely mine. She has no beneficial interest. She never paid anything. So there's also that basic question of, do I actually have a beneficial interest at all? So does each person have a beneficial interest? If so, what is that beneficial interest? And what to do about it? Should the house be sold or shouldn't it? And in that context of those sorts of disputes, we have sections 14 and 15 of Tolata, which are a sort of self-contained code of what to do in those cases. And section 14 tells us what the powers of the court are. The court essentially can do two things. Tell the trustee, so that's you, Alex, the legal owner, the person whose name is on the land register, tell you, the trustee, how to deal with the house, how you should exercise your powers as the legal owner. It can order you to do certain things. That's the less common part of the power. The by far most common part of the power that parties ask the court to exercise is the power to decide the size of the interest of each person and then decide whether or not to sell the house. Much, much more rarely, people ask the court to identify which parts of the house or land each person should occupy. That is much less common with normal-sized houses and normal relationship breakdowns. Very rarely do two people who've had a relationship breakdown want to keep sharing the same house, but living in different parts of it or partitioning it in some way. So most of the time, most people are either wanting the house sold or wanting the house not sold. And that's the majority of the cases. So those are the powers.
So you've discussed quite a lot there, Iris, about people having the interest in the property and the court determining those interests in the property. But what about when people have written their interest down, where it's in the transfer deeds or there's been an express declaration of trusts? So in terms of the proportion of the house each person owns, can the court go behind that? Can the court go behind a written declaration of trust? Is that possible? Is that something the court can do?
It's a great question, Alex, because it brings in the really key aspect of Tolata, which is this checklist of factors in Section 15, and the importance of understanding that there is a difference between what the rights of each person are, as expressed in something like a declaration of trust, and distinct from that, what the court is going to do about it. So I'm going to split your question up in terms of the answer into two parts. The first is, if there's an express declaration, whether it's in the TR1, because these days in modern conveyancing, the TR1 has a box for saying whether you plan to own the house as joint tenants or tenants in common, and if as tenants in common, what proportions? And that takes effect as an express declaration of trust. So if you've got that in your TR1, or if it's a more bespoke document created by your lawyers that sets out the proportions of ownership, that's it. Those are the proportions of ownership. Without going into the detail, with some caveats about if the behavior of the two people who've entered into that arrangement then significantly changes the way that those interests should be treated. And I'm laughing because there is a very complex and large volume of case law about that, which we can't even begin to look at. But generally speaking, what it says in the express declaration of trust is going to be what the proportions of ownership are. But that does not mean, that does not translate into the court having its hands tied about what it has to do. The way that Tolata works actually is there's a list of factors in Section 15. One of those factors is the proportionate ownership, and we'll come on to the factors in a moment. But what the court has to do is to tick off each of the factors and make findings of fact about each of the factors and what facts are relevant under each heading, and then make a decision, exercise the discretion, how to apply those factors to the dispute. As I say, 99% of the time, the question is whether or not to sell the house. So should we look at what those factors are?
Yes. So what are those factors that the court is going to take into account when making this decision?
Okay, let's go through the list. The first one is the intention, and this is where your express declaration of trust comes in.
Yes.
The intention of the person or persons who created the trust and the purposes for which the property subject to the trust is held. So the intentions and the purpose of the trust, which are, you could say, two ways of saying the same thing.
They're quite similar, but they're not the same.
Similar, but they're not exactly the same. So when you've got an express declaration of trust, you at least know what the proportions are. But does that necessarily tell you what the intentions of the, let's say, you and I are if we buy a house together and we agree the proportions? We decide we're going to hold it as tenants in common 50-50, say. Does that tell the court what our intentions were about how we were going to live in that house?
Absolutely not. It's just a question of how we might own the house.
Right.
It's not going to say what we're going to do with it.
Exactly. Now, it could be, let's think about cases that we've probably both seen. It could be that we are girlfriend and boyfriend, we live together, and the purpose of this trust is for us to share the house as a family. Right? That's the typical situation.
Yes.
But an alternative is, we've bought this, and maybe this is more likely for you and me, frankly, Alex, I've got to say, we might buy this as an investment property.
Yes,
we might say we're going to own it 50-50, but neither of us is proposing to live in it. We're going to rent it out and we're going to make a profit out of it. That's a completely different intention, isn't it? Right? So, you know, we might have talked about that. We might have not talked about that. Yeah. The court will assess what the actual intentions are. And they might find it relevant that because you and I bought this house not being a couple, that might tend to suggest that we weren't intending to share it as a family home. So all of these very fact-sensitive issues are going to come up in relation to this first factor. What is the intention of the people who created the trust? And what is the purpose for which the property was bought? What's it for? And there are cases, rare cases, I think, really, where that's been thought about very carefully. And there is not just a declaration of percentage ownership, but actually a detailed declaration of trust saying, we are buying this house as an investment, or we are buying this house to live in it together. If the relationship breaks down, this is how we propose to deal with the house. And that sort of declaration of trust where those purposes and intentions are spelled out, that's going to be a very persuasive piece of evidence for the court on a Tolata application. But it's still not determinative. It is still just one very powerful factor in a list. So shall we talk about the next factor?
Yes.
That was just, all of that was just
that
the first
factor.
That was
just one factor.
The intention just and one the purposes. Factor. But there are a number of others. The second one is the welfare of any minor, so that means child, under 18, who occupies or might reasonably be expected to occupy the house. So I think this is kind of obvious. If there's a child living in the house, or it's likely that a child is going to be living in the house, or there's an intention for a child to live in the house, that's relevant. And maybe obvious to say so, but that's relevant in relation to not selling, potentially not selling the house. So that's a factor weighing against a sale of the house, generally speaking, if there is a child under 18 who is living in that house. Again, I'm going to keep saying this, it's not determinative. It's not, you can't just say, right, there's a child here, you can't sell. That's not how it works. It's one of the factors that the court will take into account.
So it's not going to be the case then that if dad leaves the house and a child is only 2 years old, the house just can't be sold until the child's 18, because that's an awfully long time to wait. That's not going to be the case.
Well, probably not. It depends. It's for the court to decide how to deal with it. I mean, there are cases. There's a very well-known case called Edwards and Lloyds Bank from 2004, where there was a five-year order for sale. So the child was 13, 5 years away from age of majority, and the court said, we're going to make an order for sale, but it's going to be postponed until the child's 18th birthday, which is 5 years away. And that's something that a court is permitted to do, and it will be upheld on appeal as a permissible exercise of the powers in Tolata, because that is one of the factors, taking the interests of the child into account. Conversely, in your scenario where there are 16 years until the child is going to get to majority, that might be a less persuasive factor because it is such a long time to wait. But I can equally imagine a situation where actually the dad who's moved out has plenty of money, the house was always intended to be a home for the family, say, and other factors tend to go against a sale, and then maybe a judge will order a 16-year postponement. The court could order that, but it is just one of the factors. Next factor, the interests of any secured creditor or other beneficiary. So we talked about the fact that secured creditors can also make an application. So I'm a mortgage company, you're not paying your mortgage, I'm going to apply under Tolata for an order for sale. There's not much to say here except that it is one of the factors. It's not a more prominent factor than any other. Arguably, before the 1996 Act, before Tolata came into effect, the case law tended to suggest that if a creditor remained unpaid and had no prospect of being paid without an order for sale of the house being made, then that was a stronger factor in favour of a sale than other factors. That's definitely not the case anymore. Under Tolata, every factor that's listed in Section 15 is equally relevant for the court to consider. But obviously, the more money is outstanding, the longer it's been outstanding for, the more the mortgage holder needs the money. And obviously, a commercial company may not, but many mortgages are not taken by commercial companies, but by either very small companies or by family, friends who've taken a charge over a house. The more desperately the person who's out of the money needs the money, the more persuasive that would be to a judge to order a sale. But again, it is just one of the factors. And then there's a last one, the circumstances and wishes of the beneficiaries. So we've talked about what beneficiaries means. If you and I buy a house yes. together and we both have an interest in it, then we are both beneficiaries. And forget for a moment, because this is a different factor, what our intentions were when we bought the house.
Yes.
The court is now interested in what we want now, you and I. And there is no such rule as a majority vote, particularly wouldn't be useful if there were just two of us. But let's say there were three of us, you, me, and one other person. We all three of us bought the house together, it went in your name, but all three of us are beneficiaries and we each have, you know, 33.3% proportionate share and beneficial ownership. And I and my friend decide we want it sold and you, as the one out of three, don't want it sold. There is no rule that says that two out of three wins against one out of three. Again, it is just one of the factors to be taken into account. It's going to be significant for the court to take into account what the majority's wishes are, but it's not, again, a determinative factor. It is one of the factors. And it is worth just saying that under this factor, factor D, the beneficiaries whose wishes are to be taken into account specifically is defined as meaning beneficiaries who are of full age. So if there are any beneficiaries who are under 18, they are not taken into account in considering that fourth factor.
That's been really helpful. Thank you, Iris. I'm just going to summarise now what we've discussed, and hopefully you can tell me what I summarise is right, my impression of what we've discussed. So from our discussion, what I've taken is Tolata is a mechanism for sorting out disputes about houses and flats where more than one person has an interest. It's as wide as that. It's not just girlfriends and boyfriends or just two people. It might be that a number of people own the property.
The only thing Tolata doesn't apply to is a house owned by one person with only that person having a beneficial interest.
Exactly. So it applies to where there's more than one and there's no real limit there.
Absolutely. So that's a good beginning to your summary, yes.
And there isn't any automatic rule about who's going to win. So it's not the case if there is a two-year-old in the property is going to be sold. It's also not the rule that I own more of the property, so I'm a majority and I therefore win. There's four factors and those factors are balanced by the court. There's no predetermination of those factors. Is that also correct?
Yeah, that's right. It's a closed list of factors in section 15, and the court has to consider all of them and reach a decision.
And in applying all of those factors, the court makes a decision about what to do. And then when it makes a decision about what to do, it then has to work out what the order will say in order to achieve that. That's correct.
Absolutely. So there's, if you like, the question of principle. Should the court order a sale, which is, I keep saying this, 99% of the cases are about, so that's why we're talking about orders for sale. So should the court order a sale or not? That's the principal question. And then there's the practicalities. Well, how should that happen? Should the sale be now? Should the sale be later? Should there be a reserve price? Should the person who's currently living there move out before the house is put on the market? All of those things go into the court's decision-making in terms of how to structure the order. But before that, the court has to decide, should the order be made at all? And I would say that is the basics of Tolata, Alex.
Thank you, Iris. That was a really helpful summary. And thank you also for your time.
You're very welcome, Alex. It's been great to have a chat with you. And it's good to talk about Tolata.
Thank you very much, listeners, for joining us on this first episode of our podcast, Trust Issues. We hope you've enjoyed it. You can catch up on our other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.